Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yesterday was Super Tuesday with primaries around the country. Of course, our interest is in what happened, what voters said here in North Carolina, where in addition to the presidential race, candidates were running for governor, lieutenant governor, Congress, attorney general, some seats on Mecklenburg County Commission, and some other races as well. We're going to spend this hour recapping what we think are the most important races here and from any other parts of the country that hold the key to our political future. We're joined by WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Reuben Jones is with us from Spectrum News, where he covers North Carolina and national politics from Washington, and NPR's Tamara Keith, the network's senior White House correspondent, is with us as well. Good morning to you all. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Morning, Mike.
Let's talk about voter turnout in Mecklenburg County. We normally have low voter turnout, and boy, did we yesterday. Talk about it.
Yeah, so in one sense, I mean, we are a heavily Democratic county, and with no contested Democratic primary, that's going to push us low. So in a way, that's not a surprise. However, I looked this morning at all 100 North Carolina counties. We were 96th lowest in the state. And there are other Democratic urban counties that did much, much better. Durham, Wake, Buncombe, Forsyth, Guilford. So that is a big deal, I think, moving forward to November, that the turnout problem here in Mecklenburg County still seems to exist. And for Democrats running any statewide race, you've got to get more votes out of Charlotte.
Well, I was watching last night the national returns coming in from other states around the country, and it seemed like Republican voter turnout in almost all of those races, particularly in the presidential contest, was substantially higher than Democratic turnout. And that was the case here as well? And was it the case throughout North Carolina, Reuben?
Well, looking at about 24% for voter turnout in the state, you look back at 2022, it was 30%. In 2020, it was 31%, which would have been the last presidential election. I mean, it's not exactly surprising that the numbers are a little bit lower than 2020, given that that was more of a suspense surrounding Super Tuesday. We kind of knew going into this race that Nikki Haley was going to lose in North Carolina. Obviously, Joe Biden had no competition. But look, low numbers are always concerning for any campaign, especially for Democrats who want to flip this state blue come November.
Tamara, can we take these and read them as tea leaves for what might happen in November? Is this an indication of a lack of enthusiasm for the election in general, particularly at the presidential level, where people don't like either of the front runners and don't really want them to run again? Or is this just because it was a primary and Joe Biden had no competition?
Right. Certainly out talking to voters, you know, you get the impression that this is the rematch nobody was asking for or really wants. That said, it's also a primary, a largely uncontested primary, largely uncontested at this point on both sides. There was an air of inevitability heading into yesterday. And, you know, other than a surprise in Vermont, everything turned out exactly as expected, or I guess also American Samoa. So I guess what I would say is Democrats who I talk to, and I'm primarily covering President Biden's reelection, are very well aware. I also talked to the Democratic gubernatorial candidate yesterday in the state, Josh Stein, very aware that they have a problem, that they need to turn out voters. I was talking to someone from the Biden campaign yesterday who said that they realize they have a problem with African-American voters in particular, and they are viewing Black voters this cycle as persuasion targets rather than as like, oh, you're with us. We know you'll turn out. We'll talk to you at the end.
Biden also has a problem with people of Palestinian descent because a lot of them are voting none of the above. What's the term they're using?
Well, it depends on the state.
It's a protest vote in the primary to signal how dissatisfied they are and that they want a change. What will they do if there is no change in November?
Well, so I think it's really important to say that this isn't just voters of Palestinian descent. This is young voters in many cases. It's far left progressive voters. It's some African-American voters as well. All have concerns about what's happening with the war in Gaza, and they are registering their discontent in various ways. This is another thing that the Biden campaign realizes they have a problem with. Partially there is a sincere hope and a lot of effort on the part of the Biden White House to do what they can to get a ceasefire. You saw Vice President Harris literally say we need a ceasefire now, which is echoing the language of the activists, though I think under the hood she isn't actually calling for exactly what they want.
And her statement was the strongest statement thus far from the White House, but it was toned down by the White House from what she wanted to say. Steve, this was the first election where we had to face certain election law changes in North Carolina. I'm just curious if we had any problems because of the need for voter ID and because they changed rules that gave greater latitude to the way partisan poll watchers could conduct themselves at polling places. Did that cause any problems?
So, not that I am aware of. Now, that statement is kind of based on reading social media and reading other news accounts, that I did not see any big issues flare up. That being said, with the photo ID, we will get a look at the big voter file in a few weeks and go kind of dig deep and see the impact of how many people couldn't vote because they didn't have their ID or they didn't fill out their impediment form correctly. So at this point, I can't point to anything big, but we'll know a lot more soon.
So let's talk about the presidential race and the big news, I guess, this morning, if you're listening to the program in the morning and not at night, is the fact that in about 47 minutes, Nikki Haley is expected to make an announcement dropping out of this primary. She won Vermont last night. She won Washington, D.C., I think, over the weekend, which everybody says is completely not important. I think she had 17 delegates in her tote bag, her NPR tote bag, as a result of winning in Vermont. And most people have presumed that this is going to be a rematch between President Biden and former President Trump. With Super Tuesday, that's not going to be true. Nikki Haley is rumored to be planning to make that announcement later. She will drop out of the race, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But Ruben, you had a chance to talk with the former South Carolina governor, who has been a thorn in Donald Trump's side by continuing to run despite her diminishing prospects. And this is why she says she stayed in the race.
Did you look at any of the polls? In a general election poll, Marquette poll, yes, last week, Donald Trump's margin of error. I defeat Joe Biden by 18 points. You just had another New York Times poll come out today. Again, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, margin of error. I defeat Joe Biden by 8 points. You can't go and continue to see all of these things happen and say, why would we do this knowing if Donald Trump is the nominee, there is a highly possible likelihood that we could get a President Kamala Harris. At some point, we need discipline and focus back in the White House. We haven't had it for a long time, and now's the time that I think the people of North Carolina and I think the people of America want to see it.
These numbers that she's giving out, obviously pre-Super Tuesday numbers, her attacks on Donald Trump have been really mild for the most part. Only in your conversation with her, Ruben, she continued this trend of amping up that criticism.
We have got to get past the chaos that's Donald Trump. Everything he touches is chaos. I voted for Donald Trump twice. I was proud to serve America in his administration. But you can't deny the fact that chaos follows him, and we just can't keep going in this world of chaos. Our kids are dependent on what happens, and look at what they've seen. They've been through COVID. They don't know if they're going to be able to find a job. They don't know what this $34 trillion in debt means for them. They don't think they're ever going to be able to own a home. And they don't know if wars are going to break out. And all of that is under a tent of anger and division. Our kids deserve to know what normal feels like.
Ruben, where was all of that when there were other people in the Republican contest? Would it have made a difference had she spoken like that when Chris Christie was up there with Vivek Ramaswamy and others?
Yeah, there are certainly people who have asked that. Why didn't she, wasn't she more critical of Donald Trump earlier in this campaign? Why did she wait? On the flip side of that, it's not clear that that would have helped her in this Republican primary. I mean, some of what you just heard there was really strong messaging for the general election. I think a lot of independent and even Democratic voters and more moderate Republicans would agree with what she's saying. She does well against Joe Biden come November. She, you know, has a strong message in terms of the age of Trump and Biden. The problem is that's not enough to win over the Republican electorate. And we saw that play out again and again. And there were sort of two realities, Mike, when you talked to Haley going into Super Tuesday. One is what the campaign was saying is, yes, they were able to outlast all the other guys in the race except for Trump. They were raising money. They were seeing turnout at some of their rallies. And then there's the other reality, which is she only got the District of Columbia. She got Vermont on Tuesday. Her polls were, you know, not good going into Super Tuesday, and there was a big gap even in the primaries. So at some point, you have to win, and they just weren't coming for Nikki Haley.
I want to play another segment of your conversation with Nikki Haley, Ruben. She brought up something else about it speaks to how Trump ran the White House, will run the White House, plans to run the country, and now plans to run the Republican Party.
The idea that he is putting his own person as the head of the party, the idea that his campaign manager is going to run it, the idea that they said the RNC is no longer about winning parties up and down the ticket, it's about Donald Trump.
So what does that mean going forward? Because he is going to put his people in charge of the RNC. He owns that party lock, stock, and barrel. Not every Republican likes this, Tamara, which I guess accounts for the 25% that she seems to be getting in these primaries. Where are they, those voters, likely to throw their support now?
Yeah, well, the question is, do they come home or do they stay home? The Biden campaign certainly hopes that some of them will vote for him. I think there were enough Democrats who voted for Nikki Haley that those Democrats will certainly likely vote for Biden. Yeah. But in terms of In terms of the Republican voters who were done with Trump, tired of Trump, don't feel like he represents them well or would be a good leader for the country, they don't have a lot of places to go. And they're going to have to decide. And generally speaking, most Republicans ultimately do return to Trump. That's kind of just the way it goes. There obviously there's a small subset of never Trump Republicans. But a lot of people will ultimately vote for him and say, well, gosh, I just don't like his style. But they'll vote for him because they feel that President Biden is an existential threat.
And so I heard some interviews with Republican voters in North Carolina on national television yesterday. One of them, of course, these are anecdotal and these are just one person telling a reporter what they think. But one person said they voted for Haley because Trump, quote, was a lunatic and a danger to the country, end quote. Another said Haley is the voice of reason, not treason. Why wasn't that on her campaign signs?
Because she was trying to win a Republican primary.
And that's
in a party that is Trump's party. It was sort of a patron saint of lost causes there.
Yeah, that speaks to something else, because obviously he has said, Donald Trump has said, Steve, that he only wants MAGA Republicans in the party. He doesn't want anybody else in the party. So they own the party. What happens to people who identify as Republican, but not as MAGA Republicans? What are they going to do now? And I have 10 seconds.
Oh, goodness.
15.
I think that, you know, some will end up voting for Biden, but as Tamara said, some are going to kind of like come back home. I mean, they'll.
All right. We'll talk a little bit more about the two presidential front runners and how they did in Super Tuesday and here in North Carolina, and then move on to other races like the governor and members of Congress. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Super Tuesday results, particularly in North Carolina. We'll get to North Carolina in a second after we cover the presidential race with Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Reuben Jones from Spectrum News One, and Tamara Keith, senior White House correspondent for NPR. The two front runners in the presidential contest now remain all by themselves, Biden and Trump, because Nikki Haley is rumored to be announcing her suspension of her campaign coming up in just a few minutes here if you're listening in the morning. Yesterday, we listened to what some voters had to say about presidential candidates.
Definitely voted for President Trump. His policies are great. The country was doing better 3 years ago. And I'm hopeful that we can return back to that peace and prosperity.
I have some hard feelings towards President Biden and his support of sending arms to Israel and the genocide that's taking place over in Gaza right now.
Age, it does bring a lot of knowledge, and then just his experience. So I really feel confident in another 4 years with having Joe Biden as president.
They all gonna do the same thing, nothing.
President Biden is clearly very unpopular, despite all of his achievements, Tamara. Donald Trump, remarkably popular, despite of all of the things that he faces in courtrooms around the country and some of the things that happened prior to his exit from the White House years ago. Do we have collective amnesia about this? Because his poll numbers continue to rise.
I don't know that his poll numbers are in a great place. I would not say that Biden is doing vastly worse in terms of approval than Trump. What I would say is that Trump has very high approval among Republicans, and Biden has less high approval among Democrats. And so that certainly has an effect on overall approval ratings. I think that Biden allies who I have been talking to, and including Governor Cooper, believe that once people realize that this is a choice and that this isn't just about rating how you feel about the guy in the Oval Office, who has the burden of being the guy in the Oval Office and will inevitably do things that upset people, once people sort of focus on the fact that it's a choice, Governor Cooper and others in the Biden camp believe that things will change. The old don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. Certainly a lot of money is going to be spent to make sure that people understand the choice. I do think that there has been a tuning out of Trump. I know that's hard to believe because he produces so much content and people talk about him and think about him all the time. A lot of people aren't thinking about him. A lot of people have been very happy not to think about him for 3.5 years or whatever.
One of the problems that Democrats face, I think, is the fact that they've framed the last several elections as the most important elections of our lifetimes. And this could be the most important election in the history of the country. And they are framing this race rightfully as the last stand against the fall of democracy. They are hoping to use not just Trump's embrace of authoritarians and his promise to be a dictator on day one, but also threats posed to the future of IVF, to women's rights, even contraception, voters' rights, minority rights being posed by Republicans in office nationwide and in legislatures nationwide. Republicans, on the other hand, are depending on voters to reject Biden because of his age and what they refer to as his disastrous economic and foreign policy and his condemn his approach to border security. Yet Biden helped craft a bill 2 weeks ago with Republican support that gave Republicans everything they wanted, and Republicans shot it down because Donald Trump wants an issue to run on in the election. So what were voters thinking about yesterday? Any of these things? All of these things? What would they be thinking about in November? Steve?
I will mention one thing. What I was looking up just now, when we played that clip earlier of the voter who was upset at Biden for support of Israel. And in the Democratic primary, 13% were uncommitted. I think we've seen that percent kind of similar to other states. I went back just for fun and looked at the last uncontested Democratic primary here, 2012, when Obama was being reelected. It was like, strangely, 20% were uncommitted in that one. I mean, which is, you know, it. So it's interesting, the uncommitted thing. I mean, and of course, Obama did not win North Carolina that year, but won re-election. You know, I do think a lot of the Democrats will eventually come around, and as Tamara said, will kind of, you know, realize this is a choice and not a, and they'll come around. I just thought that was interesting looking back.
Tamara, it's unlikely that any of the serious criminal violations that Donald Trump faces will come to any kind of conclusion prior to the election now, thanks in large part to a decision made last week by the Supreme Court. What happens if those trials do proceed and he is found guilty and he's been elected president of the United States?
I don't know that they will proceed if he is the president.
You mean if he's the president elect?
So I think that we will be in very uncharted territory is what I would say. What I will also say is we're already in very uncharted territory. I think it is quite likely though that the New York case is proceeding apace. And it's possible that at least one of the federal cases could get to trial before the election. That is certainly the intent of the special counsel, Jack Smith. Who knows? They're trying to set a date in the documents case by some point in the summer. But again, like, this isn't like some Deus ex machina that's going to come in and like change everything necessarily. There are polls do find that some decent sized share, like 30% of Republican voters, say that if Trump is convicted of a felony, they'd have a hard time voting for him. But, I don't think that the Biden campaign, for instance, is counting on that.
Yeah. And I want to point out in Rubin's interview with Nikki Haley, she maintained that if she had been elected and he was convicted, she would pardon him. And she used the excuse, Rubin, that I think Gerald Ford used when he pardoned Nixon, that the country would be better off for that. I think looking back on that, you weren't alive then, but I was. I think looking back on that, many people who lived through that disagree with President Ford about that decision. Would they disagree with Nikki Haley if she ever had a chance to make that decision, which now she won't?
Yeah, she won't get that chance. But yeah, I mean, I asked her, I said, what about the argument from the other 50% of the country that if you were to pardon him, they would be upset? And she said, well, in that case, you would still have the former president in a jail cell, basically complaining and yelling and creating more division within the country. So that was sort of the tightrope that Haley had been walking in this campaign, is I'm going to be critical of Trump, at least in the latter couple weeks. But how critical do I go to not turn off the base of the Republican Party?
So let's move on to the governor's race in North Carolina. Roy Cooper, of course, the Democratic governor, is term limited. He couldn't run again, but he endorsed his attorney general, Josh Stein. It was a two-way race in the primary, pretty much, but pitting Josh Stein against former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Morgan. And Steve, the outcome was a foregone conclusion, do you think?
I think the outcome was a foregone conclusion. Stein got nearly 70%. I think if we would have gone back in the fall when Morgan announced his campaign, I think a lot of people thought that he would run a more competitive race. He came out of the gate with this great biographical video about him being the first African-American student at his elementary school. It was very inspiring. And then there just wasn't much after that. I mean, there was just really nothing.
Yeah.
And so again, the fact Stein won, I think everyone expected that, but it was never a contest.
And Stein used his remarks in his victory speech last night to remind people of his now opponent, Lieutenant Governor Robinson's normally inflammatory remarks.
We're at a crossroads, and the choice before us, two competing visions for North Carolina. Mark Robinson's vision is bleak and divisive, consumed by spite and hate.
And Mark Robinson, of course, got Donald Trump's unequivocal endorsement not too long ago. He ran against several people, among them Republican State Treasurer Dale Falwell, who said that Dale Falwell was the most electable candidate in November. Do you think, Steve, since Lieutenant Governor Robinson has the nomination on the Republican side, that that will prove to be true?
I think that, you know, we've got 10 council of state races. I think a lot of people feel that, let's say if President Trump wins North Carolina, Robinson will be kind of the ninth or 10th across the finish line, you know, that he will probably lag everyone else. That being said, you know, he of course has a very good chance of winning, but I think he will need a reasonably, a pretty sizable Trump win of 3 or 4 points, 5 points to get across the finish line.
Robinson, we know this because we live in North Carolina, but the national media, when they talk about him, has been focusing on some of the remarks he's made in the past that are repugnant to many people, controversial at the very least. He did not do that last night, at least not from what I know about, in his victory speech. Instead, he focused on middle class pain.
I have an opponent who doesn't understand what it's like to be at work and have the boss man come and take you to a room and sit you down and tell you, we're moving this plant to Mexico and there's nothing you can do about it. And now you have to go find another job. I know the sting. I know the sting of the bad federal policy that causes that. And I'm here for the people of North Carolina for it. Now, people ask me, what's the difference between you and your Democratic challenger? The answer is simple. I'm part of a winning team. He's part of a losing team.
So, Ruben, if Stein wins in November, he would be the state's first Jewish governor. If Robinson wins, he will be the state's first black governor. And according to Western Carolina University political scientist, our buddy Chris Cooper, quote, if you went to a candidate factory and said, create me the two most different candidates possible, I don't think you could do any better. They're just radically different in demeanor, in ideology. What does that say about the two parties in North Carolina and these two candidates, but also about the voters?
Yeah, I think it says that Republican base is a solid Trump base. I mean, Mark Robinson is sort of very Trump-esque, so you have that. But yeah, you really can't be too starkly different on this. I mean, Josh Stein has sort of been running for governor for many years in a way as an attorney general in that position. But I'll also say that we're going to have a divisive race that's going to raise a lot of money, going to be ugly, going to get a lot of national attention on the governor's side. And just one seat below that in the attorney general's race, it looks very similar with Dan Bishop, who I cover in Congress extensively, member of the House Freedom Caucus, very conservative, outspoken, on the more far right, if you will, against Jeff Jackson, a Democrat who was also in Congress, who is sort of a social media TikTok star and has a lot of name recognition. I mean, these two races are going to be fascinating and frankly, probably quite ugly.
Steve, I think it was last year when the governor made his State of the State address, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson was chosen by his party to deliver the response to that address. And in that address that he made, he was as mainstream as anybody has ever seen him. And I think that was to set up this race, his race for the governor. Which version of that person are we likely to get if he's elected?
At any kind of scheduled event where media is expected and the cameras are on, we will get the Mark Robinson that we heard earlier about, you know, about his rise from poverty, et cetera. That is who we're going to get. The problem is for him, you know, he struggles to stay on message when he is speaking to churches or when he is speaking to conservative groups. You know, he had the hot mic moment just a few weeks ago where he talked about abortion and said, we got it to 12, we're going to go to 6 and we're going to keep going and roll it back. So, you know, in that primary, Bill Graham, the Salisbury attorney, who's probably spent $2 million of his own money, you know, he said repeatedly, Robinson can't win. We are going to lose. And, you know, he tried. He had the money to get his message out, and it just no one No one was interested.
So, Tamara, the North Carolina governor's race is going to likely be the most watched, perhaps the most important, certainly the most expensive gubernatorial race in this next election cycle. How tight might it be in November, and what impact will that have on either which presidential candidate carries this race, or what impact will the leading presidential candidate have on who wins the gubernatorial contest?
Right. So first off, this is going to be a crazy expensive, crazy negative. Like just, you know, you're going to need to clean your television sets after all these ads air, because it's going to be rough. And the thing with Robinson is that it's not just that he's said these things, it's that there's video. And so that's sort of an opposition research dream that Democrats are looking forward to. But like, This is not an easy race for Democrats by any stretch of the imagination. Robinson is a compelling figure on the right, and he's going to be right next to former President Trump. And let me say that both Trump and Biden very much want and need to win North Carolina, and it's not clear right now which direction the coattails go. Biden obviously does have approval problems. And so I will be watching to see how much time Josh Stein actually spends with President Biden. But what I do know is that there is a very strong commitment on the Democratic side, at least for now, to compete in the state, to build a ground operation, to really campaign up and down the ballot. On the Republican side, the very likely new RNC chairman has kept a strong political operation going in the state, sort of not having the boom and bust cycles that often afflict state parties.
Abortion is going to be a very big issue. It is a very, very big issue, and Democrats are depending on it to remain so. Republican mm-hmm. Senate leader Phil Berger in North Carolina says he doesn't anticipate any further changes in North Carolina abortion restrictions in the near future. But Robinson has said he supports a total ban on abortion. Steve, were he to win, and certainly the Republicans are going to maintain their control of the legislature, can we anticipate more abortion restrictions going into place?
Clearly, yeah. Looking at 2025, I think in the equation, Phil Berger is more powerful than Mark Robinson in this state. We have a weak executive. But will Mark Robinson kind of mount pressure? Will he try to roll it back? We'll see.
Okay, we're coming back. We'll talk about the Attorney General and the congressional races that happened yesterday when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. So we're talking about Super Tuesday election results here in North Carolina. Well, big election day yesterday, of course. Tamara Keith is here. She's senior White House correspondent for National Public Radio. Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE News. And Reuben Jones, Washington reporter covering national and North Carolina politics for Spectrum News. We referenced the Attorney General race a moment ago, in which two congresspeople were going at it head-to-head. Very popular TikTok champion Democrat Jeff Jackson against a Tea Party Republican who was the most conservative person in the North Carolina legislature when he was there, and is among the most conservative people in Congress now that he's there. And I'm talking, of course, about Dan Bishop. As you mentioned, Reuben, it's going to be Bishop and Jackson in the fall. How tight is this going to be, do you think?
I think it could be very tight. Potentially. I mean, I think it will be interesting to see how well people in the state have followed Dan Bishop. I mean, he was in the General Assembly before he got up to Congress, and was sort of behind the bathroom bill as well. And so have they followed him into Congress, where he has been sort of skeptical of some of the funding towards Ukraine? He has a member of the Freedom Caucus, been was critical of Speaker Kevin McCarthy when he was in power. So does that influence the general electorate come North Carolina? We'll wait and see. But this race will be very interesting also because you just have two sitting members of Congress, which is kind of unusual running for an attorney general's race. Remember, Jeff Jackson is only really running for this seat because he doesn't have a job anymore in Congress because his district got redistricted. It's too Republican.
Something happened in this race that's happened elsewhere in the country in this election cycle, Tamara. Republicans had been funding a super PAC promoting Santana Deberry's, if that's how you say her name's, Democratic candidacy in this race. She lost, obviously, to Jeff Jackson. Out in California, Adam Schiff, his campaign funded Steve Garvey's campaign so that Steve Garvey would be the candidate against him in November. Is that because he didn't want to run against other Democrats? Because the California setup for the primaries is kind of strange.
So I'm from California. You're asking the right person. So what Adam Schiff did was not, it was not exactly explicitly running ads for Steve Garvey. What he was doing is running ads saying Garvey's too conservative for California, which of course was like, all right, Republicans, here's your signal, vote for this guy. Garvey didn't spend a lot of money himself. He did have the advantage of being a popular baseball player back in the day for the Los Angeles Dodgers. In California, it is sometimes referred to as a jungle primary. It's a top two. It's essentially an open primary. Everybody competes, and then the top two candidates win. But it's an overwhelmingly Democratic state. So if Adam Schiff, which he succeeded at doing, could get himself a Republican opponent, he basically can stop campaigning into November. Like the primary was the race.
Yeah, in California, the two winners in the primary go up against each other in November. So it could have been two Democrats running against each other.
The optics of that
would have been horrible. I'm not sure why they do that, but that's California. Let's move on.
Tell you why. The goal is moderation. The goal is to have the most moderate candidate, to have people campaign to the center.
What a concept.
It doesn't always work.
So let's talk about the congressional races, because the control of the House of Representatives right now by Republicans is infinitesimally small, and Democrats hope to get it back. They also hope to maintain the Senate, but we don't have any Senate races in North Carolina this time around. So let's focus on Congress, where gerrymandering is going to change the complexion of the North Carolina delegation from a kind of a 50-50 split Democrat-Republican to a Republican majority, no matter who won these primaries. What will that do, and what does it look like nationally for Republicans versus Democrats in the Congress, Tamara?
What about Ruben?
All right, well, Ruben, go ahead.
Tamara, you can handle it, too. I've been trying to emphasize to people that, yes, this is a primary election that sometimes feels kind of boring and uninteresting. This is a general election, pretty much, what we had yesterday in terms of the vast majority of the races in North Carolina in Congress. 13 of the 14 seats were basically decided tonight, with exception of some runoffs. There's only one swing district in North Carolina come November. So right now, just to really quickly, North Carolina sends 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans to Congress. Because of a new congressional map drawn by state Republican lawmakers, that goes from 7 Democrats down to likely 4 Democrats, and the Republicans climb up to likely 10, and then you've got one swing district. So, I mean, this is a Democratic devastation from this new map.
And what will this is happening in Republican-controlled states, I would think, across the country, because the legislature draws the maps in many of these locations. What are Democrats and Republicans anticipating after the November election, the House of Representatives, to look like? You're there every day, Ruben.
Nobody knows in terms of what control of House will look like after November. I mean, I think there was a thought, though, going in that the House was going to lean more towards Democrat, given that New York was likely going to have its own round of gerrymandering and be really good for Democrats. It doesn't look like New York is going to pick up as many Democrats to make up for the North Carolina losses. So it's really a toss-up.
So let's go through some of these local district races that are important to people who live in our listening area. The 8th Congressional District featured Mark Harris, who is famous because of what happened to Mark Harris in several election cycles ago. He won election, and then there was ballot fraud, and there was a hearing, and during that hearing he said, you know, there ought to be a new election. Well, they took him up on it. They had a new election. He chose not to run in it, and Dan Bishop was sent to Congress. Now, Dan Bishop is coming home to run for attorney general, and Mark Harris has decided to run again for Congress in a different district because of the redraw of the maps. Well, he won. And people were debating about whether or not what happened several years ago was going to be a factor. Last night, Mark Harris said clearly no.
The 8th district people stood up and said, this district is not for sale. Yeah. And you did it. You did it.
Well, does he have any competition in that race, Ruben, going forward in November?
No. And not in the 8th district. He's basically locked it up. He might, to be honest with you, I don't know on the Democratic side, but
there's
it's
one Democratic candidate, but it's a Trump plus 18. So
he's in. He's going to Congress finally at long last. In the 10th district, this is another district where I think there was only one Democrat running, Ralph Scott Jr., but there were five on the Republican side, Charles Eller, Pat Harrigan, Diana Jimison, Brooke McGowan, and Gray Mills. Now, I saw a ton of commercials for Gray Mills, but they didn't seem to help. Who won? Ruben, who won?
That would be Pat Harrigan, who ran and was the Republican nominee in the 14th district in 2022. And yeah, he beat Gray Mills, who was a sitting lawmaker. Remember, this is Patrick McHenry's seat.
Yes.
Perhaps the most influential member in Congress from North Carolina last year, serving as acting Speaker of the House. He did not, by the way, endorse in this race.
You were there. Why? He could have been the Speaker of the House had he wanted to, but instead he decided to leave Congress. Why did Patrick McHenry do that?
I think there were multiple reasons, including that, you know, he'd been there 20 years, which is a long time. He felt that he had.
No, tell that to Mitch McConnell.
Yes, exactly. But he had also lost his chairmanship of being leading the House Financial Services Committee starting next year. And that's sort of where he is passionate about it. I mean, you can talk to him and he is passionate about policy, not so much about the politics. And so, you know, he doesn't like to say it, but I mean, there's a lot of lawmakers who are also tired of the dysfunction that's happening.
In the 6th Congressional District, a frequent guest on this program, Brian Anderson of Anderson Alert Substacks, wrote, "Don't call it House of Cards and don't call it Veep. Call it North Carolina's 6th Congressional District, where drama and comedy unite to form what is arguably the state's most unpredictable primary contest." Ruben, would you agree with that? And particularly given the outcome, this is going to be a runoff.
Yes, I don't know if it was the most unpredictable. It was one of probably two that was most unpredictable in the state last night. And this is the one that has the most national interest, I think, because it speaks to what is the power of a Trump endorsement in 2024 versus 2022-2020. And the winner in this was someone I had never frankly heard of. Steve, maybe you had.
Nope.
Anderson McDowell, who got the Trump endorsement, I think a few months ago. He beat Mark Walker, but not enough to avoid a runoff. Mark Walker used to represent this district, but there were four candidates in this race that could have potentially won last night, also Christian Castelli and Bo Hines.
And am I wrong in saying that when Addison McDowell got the Trump endorsement, it was a surprise to local party leaders and to Addison McDowell himself?
I've heard that. I can't confirm that, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay. Kathy Manning, the Democrat, held that seat. She announced that she would not run for re-election. Is that because it was just impossible for a Democrat to win given the way the district was redrawn?
Kathy Manning would absolutely like to be running for re-election. She dropped out because her district's too Republican. She joined Jeff Jackson and she joined Wiley Nickel, who were in the same boat.
Speaking of Jeff Jackson, District 14, this was Jeff Jackson's district, and two Democrats ran in the primary there. Pamela, is it Gennant? Is that how you say her name? I'm sorry, I just don't know. and Brendan McGinnis, and there were three people on the GOP side, Jeff Gregory, Lillian Joseph, and North Carolina Speaker of the House, Tim Moore. Well, no surprise there. Tim Moore's on the Republican side. Who won the Democratic primary in the 14th?
Steve, you want to?
Yeah, I think Pat Jennett will be Moore's opponent, but again, not much of a contest.
Okay. When it comes down to local races or more local races, we WFA had a chance to speak to some more voters about how they approached pushing that button in the voting booth yesterday.
Well, for me, it's the local stuff. So my board of commissioners, that was the thing that I came in here knowing that I really wanted to be able to impact the most.
Kind of just nervous in general. Like sometimes when I vote, I wonder if it's going to matter in the end. Like I voted for Tricia Cotham, and that was a huge bummer.
Tricia Cotham, of course, is the Democrat who won election to the state house last time and then immediately became a Republican, giving the state house Republicans a supermajority in the House. And Democrats have been up in arms about it ever since. And we talked, Steve, I think it was last week, about what impact the defection of Tricia Cotham to the Republicans would have on her mother, Pat Cotham, who is a longtime Democratic county commissioner here in Mecklenburg. She lost yesterday. Is that why?
I think that's absolutely why. I think everyone thought she was going to lose some support over the Tricia Cotham flip. She was beaten really badly. I mean, she lost. She finished out of third by 14,000 votes. There's only one explanation. That is the party switch.
And on the Democratics, well, speaking of, well, Trish Cotham is in. She's running again as a Republican in her House district. Nicole Sidman won the Democratic primary and will face her in District 105 in the fall. In this clip, she talks about her disappointment in what Cotham did by switching parties last year.
As soon as I mentioned that I was running against Trish Cotham in the fall, animation immediately, and they said, you know, we've got to get this done because it's just not fair what she did.
So given the fact that Tricia Cotham's defection had an impact on her mother in the county commission race, and her mother had been really popular and entrenched in that race, and she lost, as you said, badly, is this a sign that Tricia Cotham is in serious trouble in that district? Steve.
I think it's a 50-50 district. Republicans will spend a ton of money to try and keep her and try and support her. But I do think it's a sign that people are aware. I mean, you know, everyone going in that district is going to know and understand the stakes and understand the backstory. So, yes, I think it's a big sign of what could be to come.
Another. Go ahead.
And it's a district that was drawn to be obviously more favorable to now Republican Tricia Cotham. I think that it is going to be an expensive race. I think, like, normally a state house race wouldn't get national attention. This state house race is going to get national attention just because of the stakes. And also, you know, when I was in the district interviewing voters, the vast majority of them, I would ask, what is the most important issue to you? And they would say abortion, reproductive rights. And what I can tell you is that Democrats up and down the ballot are hoping to harness that outrage here in North Carolina.
I guess this could be called an upset, but yesterday in the race for superintendent of public education, the incumbent Republican, Catherine Truitt, lost to Republican Michelle Morrow. Michelle Morrow, as I understand it, homeschools her children. She is extremely conservative, and she's going to run for the superintendent of public instruction. Talk about her, Steve.
Yeah, this was a huge upset. I mean, not only was Truitt an incumbent, she, of course, had more money. And Michelle Morrow, like you said, homeschools her children. She said a lot of inflammatory things about public education. I think she's called the schools indoctrination centers. So this was a close race, but a huge shock. She will face Democrat Mo Green, who used to work for CMS in the fall. So, you know, kind of this race will be in kind of that Mark Robinson mode fascinating, fascinating upset.
So I have about 30 seconds left, Tamara. Yesterday, Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona decided she would not run for re-election. And later this week, the No Labels Party is rumored to be making an announcement about what they intend to do. Could she be the candidate?
I suppose anything's possible. They had said that they wanted a Republican at the top of the ticket, and the field of willing Republicans continues to wane.
Tamara Keith is senior White House correspondent for NPR. Steve Harrison is our political reporter here at WFAE News. And Reuben Jones joined us, Washington reporter for Spectrum News One. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.